The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
This is a period of time where you want to be cautious because of the character of the central planners, because of the trends in play which define you as an average investor, who is nothing more than fodder for the system. Understand what you represent and who you are to the system, and you'll have a much better idea of how to play this over the next few years.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I love talking about some of your excursions outside of the office. And last night late, I got a chance to look at some of the film clips from your weekend. And honest to goodness, it looked like one of those extreme movies where you have the sunshine, you've got the helicopters going past, you're on top of mountain peaks that look like you're somewhere in Alaska. But actually, this weekend, you were just up north of here, up in Silverton, where a lot of the old gold and silver mining was done.
It's only a stone's throw away, and it is a remarkable spot. This weekend, I was skiing in, I think, what is one of the most spectacular places in North America. And yeah, it's just outside a very small town here in Colorado. You've got a single lift. You have a tent at the bottom of the hill instead of a lodge.
Right.
And you find a gathering of sort of no-frills ski enthusiasts that love challenge, are inspired by beauty, and they don't mind sacrificing comfort for steep slopes and fantastic snow.
Well, and this is known as one of the most extreme public ski areas in the world as far as steepness, avalanches. You guys, I think you wear probes and you actually wear backpacks that inflate if you get into an avalanche, don't you?
There's a cute little sign as you're getting onto the lift that explains that there is nothing but double diamonds on the mountain.
This isn't where you come to learn.
No, and they explain all of the risks that are included, including, I mean, it says on the sign, and you may die. And I thought, you know, this is interesting. I actually get more of this than I do out of, say, you know, the pharmaceutical industry. Who they have all the same caveats. They just have to speak very quickly. You have the benefit of this, but you may also bleed out of every orifice and find yourself in a heap, the equivalent of an Ebola virus patient. But, and then the music plays, it'll be wonderful.
Well, and sadly, it has happened up there. I mean, those signs are for real. Now, I know people fly in from all over for this, and you guys had a small group. What was it, about 8 people? But it was a mixture of a lot of different nationalities, states, what have you.
Over the 2 days, we had 2 different countries, 5 different states. And at one point in our conversation while we're up there, we turned to sort of real estate values in the town of Silverton. I'm always kind of doing sleuthing and research, and there was a spike in foreclosures, which came after the closing of the last mining operation in the 1990s. And our guide, who's been up there for 7 years, was intrigued to discover that the shuttered mines, when that happened in the 90s, basically missed the bottom of the market by a matter of months. I mean, it was really interesting. She recounted that it was late 1998 was sort of the end of the mining era in Silverton. I've heard other people say, no, it's 1991. I don't know. But I explained how there was a similar dynamic that existed today.
Isn't that normally a sign when you start seeing the shuttering of an industry, it could be the bottoming of an industry before the next rise?
Well, that's exactly right. The mines were shuttered and you basically missed the bottom of the market. And if you moved on or shuttered those mines, you were moving on at exactly the wrong time.
Hmm.
So back in the late 90s, when the mining industry was hemorrhaging, gold and silver, of course, were in the crosshairs at lows they hadn't seen in 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. There were bankruptcies, there were mine closures, and projects that were suspended. And she was very quick to respond. And this is our guide. She says, well, that sounds like right now, because I told her a little bit about what we did in the precious metals and asset management business. And she said, it sounds like it's time to buy again. It's almost like 1998, 1999.
I'll bet you said, uh-huh.
I said, yes, that's correct. But most investors rarely move into an asset at the low price. Here's a gal who bought a foreclosure in Silverton, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, she gets it. She understands value. And when things are cheap, they're that much more compelling. And on paper, it does make sense that you buy things when they're cheap. But people don't live on paper. And they tend to live in a world of ideas. They live in a world of emotions and scars and stripes and expectations that, if not met in a particular time frame, you know, disallows them from separating subjective versus objective reality. So they live in this, I can't take the pain anymore, not aware of what's going in a broader context.
Well, and Dave, we can feel what they were feeling in Silverton at the time because we were there. I mean, your family's been in the gold business for, you know, over four decades, almost five decades. I've been with the family for almost three decades, and I remember the 90s. I mean, gold got down to 252, was it? And that's when they were closing those mines. Now gold's kissing about 1200. It's been higher.
And they're actually in the same process. They have been over the last 6 to 12 months. Mine closures,
right.
Mothballing different projects. And I think the reality is, as investors, we live our lives in the first person. And sometimes that puts us too close to the trees to see the forest. And, you know, whether that is not gaining enough perspective to be reflective individually, or from a financial perspective, just lacking adequate view to be able to take in where you're at and where you're going, but being lost sort of in the moment.
Dave, this last several weeks has been very interesting for me just personally. I mean, from a mental and emotional standpoint, I wouldn't think that I was that emotional about the markets, but I've been sickened over the last 3 years about the comatose nature of all the markets. It's as if the trust in the central banks had taken away these beautiful forces called market forces. Now, I'm going to be honest. I don't care whether gold goes down or up if they just leave it the heck alone. But it's been comatose for the last 3 years. I felt over the last couple of weeks like I'm watching an old friend blink its eyes after being in a coma for 3 years. I'm starting to see life. I'm seeing my old friend gold, and it's starting to tell the truth about the markets instead of what somebody's trying to tell me about the markets.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting that idea of sort of a traumatic event where a medical practitioner, emergency medical service person will induce a coma in order to sort of control the state. And yet markets are now coming out of a controlled state,
yeah,
and they're beginning to react to real things. So the Fed-induced coma that was powerfully felt through 2012, 13, 14, 15, things are changing. And it's our contention that since 2013, real things in the marketplace have still been there as real issues to pay attention to and real risks to be appraised of, but they've been ignored. And they've become temporarily irrelevant due to central bank interventionism.
Because the prices were not accurately reflecting what was going on.
Right. Now we have a reappraisal of central bank effectiveness, which is underway, and with it, a reappraisal of gold. And just as a reminder, it was Larry Summers who wrote in the Summers-Barsky thesis about how gold plays a role in a low to negative real rate environment. So he was clarifying the real appeal of gold in that low to negative real rate environment. And he was talking about real rates, that is, your interest once you factor out the cost of inflation. But he was not in that paper addressing nominal rates, where you can actually set them negative. And I think it implies even more in the context of negative nominal rates. An investor today is looking and saying, okay, well, where does the migration need to be? And I think the migration is just getting ready to begin. Look, even this last week, Karuta speaks. And ordinarily, when a central banker has spoken for the last 3 or 4 years,
right,
there is market impact, and that market impact has some legs to it. In other words, let's say Kuroda over at the Bank of Japan says something significant. Guess what? It may cause a rally in the Nikkei for 2 to 4 weeks.
Right.
Now Kuroda speaks and the Nikkei falls 3%. And I think sentiment has shifted. Draghi, same thing last week. You know, there's an initial, literally like 5-minute positive response to his comments. And then all of a sudden, the Euro stock markets either sit still or drop. Again, I think it's sentiment shifting as we go back to that markets are coming out of the coma.
Well, and you know, the central bankers have almost been Marvel superheroes. You know, they'll come out and it's like they're there to save the world. You have Bernanke when he was there. Anytime he would talk and say something positive about the markets, it'd go up. Or if he'd say something negative, it'd go up even more because it meant that he was going to give them some candy. You know, we had Yellen, we had Karuta, we had Draghi. These guys could come out and literally make the stock market go up hundreds of points or down hundreds of points and then give it some candy. But like you said, they're losing control. Now the markets are starting to say, wait a second, I'm waking up. I've been in a coma for 3 years, but wait a second, I'm going to tell the truth.
There is an argument, and certainly Richard Fisher at the Dallas Fed, he retired last year, you know, has said, look, we've got the big guns at the Fed and they're out of ammunition. And I agree with that and I disagree with it.
Right.
I agree that they are in a corner. I agree that there's not much that they can do. But the ammunition yet to be spent is in that negative rate territory.
Negative rates and cashless society.
That's right.
We talked about the cashless society last week and how much information is coming out of central banks. But did you see the PayPal commercial during the Super Bowl?
It was fantastic.
It basically was saying everything we were saying last week. You know, the old money is cash. They showed pictures of these old men on bills and, you know, Ben Franklin and Ulysses S. Grant. And then it said, but the new money is for the people. And they showed pictures of very attractive people. You know, they end the commercial with an attractive gal just smiling into the camera. She represents the new cashless society.
I don't know exactly what that gal had to do with cashless society or PayPal, except that you smile and that's your last impression. You're like, oh, okay.
Right. But negative rates. Okay. So how do you keep money in the bank if you're paying someone negative rates, which means you're taking from someone some of their cash? You give them cashless society and you make them captive.
What I think most people have forgotten is the changing nature of our entire financial system. When you go back to 2008 and 2009, not only have we got an intervention from the central banks to save your commercial banks, but the cry, the battle cry at the moment was too big to fail.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't let them fail. They're too big to fail. And lo and behold, the too big to fail institutions are now 30, 40, 50, even 60% larger than they were before. And you think to yourself, maybe that was by design. Maybe the proper response to any crisis is to consolidate power and influence and control. And maybe what you have in real time is a soft nationalization of the entire financial system via the banks. And in fact, we are going to do away not only with cash, but with the branch banking system that you've known, where you are a depositor at this bank and we're just all a part of one financial system. Forget the relationship.
It's like Robert Higgs, build the Leviathan, create the crisis, build the Leviathan, create another crisis, make it even bigger. Dave, going back to gold, you brought something up a month and a half ago, actually at the end of 2015, that the relationship between the gold mines, you were talking about these shuttered mines, and the price of gold had reached almost a historic separation or a gap, which might have been a signal at the time that the gold market was bottoming out.
Well, just as real estate was an indicator to you of a bottoming out and of a bust phase, if you will, in the gold mining space in Silverton. You know, you said, okay, well, we've got foreclosures. You've lost 150 guys that were mining and making $60 to $80 an hour, and you can't make that kind of money in Silverton outside of this particular industry. So they lose their house, all this stuff happens. They're indicators. The real estate market in that place was telling you what was happening in the mining industry, and the mining industry was telling you what was happening in the gold market, that it was as bad as it gets. And in December of 2015, you had the relationship between physical gold and the companies that mine it that reached a five-decade extreme. A five-decade extreme. And for those of us that know the wide gyrations in price and the relative values between gold miners and the physical asset itself, this is a signal not only that we are at the end of a consolidation cycle, but that both the metals and the companies that mine them are now on sale.
Right.
So if you recall, again, to throw in the towel on the miners in 1998, 1999, 2000, and to throw in the towel on gold in that same time frame, it was naive. Investors were wrong then, and they're wrong now, to believe that pendulums swing only one direction.
You know, Dave, unlike owning the physical metal, when you're buying mines, you have to take other things into account. Sometimes they can work against you, sometimes they can work for you. Right now, there's an amazing advantage because a lot of the mines are peso-denominated labor, you know, that's paying for the gold that's coming out. And as we know, the peso's lost quite a bit of value, but that gold is still being sold in the market for U.S. dollars.
Well, sure. And whether it's the South African rand or the Canadian dollar or the Australian dollar, the reason for mentioning the Mexican peso is actually twofold. One, vacation there is truly cheaper with the depreciated peso. So, you know, whether it is time to vacation in Puerto Vallarta or Cancun or Acapulco, the peso is at a record low, 18.75 to the US dollar, which is far worse in terms of an exchange rate than the market extremes of 2008 and 2009.
It was 12 to 1, if I remember right, even when I went to my brother's wedding. He lives down in Puerto Vallarta.
And then it stretched ultimately to 15 and recovered to 12, and now we're at 18. But it also, I think the second point worth mentioning on the Mexican peso is that it serves to illustrate this critical issue. You've got miners that have major operations in Mexico, and this applies to Canada and Australia as well, and they pay their bills in the local currencies.
Mm-hmm.
So the peso dollar exchange rate has fallen by 50%. We were at 12 to 1, now it's 18 to 1. The Canadian dollar's fallen by 30% relative to the dollar. The Aussie dollar's about the same as the loonie as well. And if expenses are paid in those currencies, but the price of the product you sell is realized in US dollars, you've gained even if the dollar price of gold was stagnant. Now, that's not the case. We find year to date, the increase in the US dollar gold price is up over 10%, and silver is up over 9% just since January 1. And if you roll the clock back slightly, since the Fed rate rise, which of course many analysts were predicting would devastate the gold price, we argued that actually it's nowhere near a threshold that would hurt gold. But gold has increased since that point, since the Fed meeting, by 13%, even as U.S. equities have dropped anywhere from 10 to 25%, depending on the index and the sector that's in view. So you have in certain jurisdictions, whether it's Mexico or Canada or Australia or South Africa, you have in certain jurisdictions the double benefit of a currency decline, which alleviates your wage and expense pressures, and you have a bump higher in the cost of the commodity you produce. These are the jurisdictions I would certainly snoop around in.
Well, let me ask you, your family has gone back to South Africa many, many times. Your father took groups over there, I think 30 some odd times before he finished doing that. What about South Africa? Because we have the same dynamic going on there, but it's less stable. I mean, it's hard to say that it's less stable than Mexico itself, but it is less stable. Is it not?
It is less stable. I'm going to be down there in July of this year, speaking at a conference. And I would say that while South Africa has the same benefits, it has less legal assurances. And as an investor, you're not sure you're going to get to keep what you mine. South Africa is, to a large degree, a political disaster zone. Mm. And it's a much higher risk than the other jurisdictions mentioned. There are certainly values there, for sure. But as you mentioned, we've been traveling there as a family and have had investment interests there since probably the 1960s. And all I can say is that the risk there can only be moderated by the depth of discount applied to the assets. At the right price, most things can become intriguing. But I've stayed away from South African investments since 2004.
Well, going back to physical gold, like I said, it really is like seeing the awakening of an old friend. The one thing I've always loved about gold, and I think every generation really for the last 4,000 years has loved about gold, is ultimately it tells you the truth.
Well, that's right. So gold is performing like gold again, and that's after a 3-year identity crisis. Because you see, it performed exceptionally well through 2012. Normal, anyways. And even with the correction in 2012 in price, that was to be expected. It was healthy. It was within the realm of reasonable behavior within that market. But from 2013 to 2015, the belief that central bankers had redefined the nature of risk and invented new tools to mitigate it indefinitely put gold into sort of this twilight zone of identity confusion.
Well, it's like the Avengers I was talking about. You know, they thought the Marvel superheroes could come in and save the day. That's never worked in the past, and it looks like it's not working now.
So we have misplaced confidence in the central bank community, and that was the primary contributor to the confused identity 2013 to 2015. But on a number of occasions, including last year, at this time, gold was trying to gain traction as what we've known it, well, again, you say 5,000-year history, it's true, as a wealth preservation tool. And each time in the last couple of years, it's been clobbered.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, perhaps it will be again. But it appears that monetary policy, legitimacy, and effectiveness are being reappraised. And we're talking about in the Asian context, we're talking about in the American context, we're talking about in Europe, where in each of these spheres, there's disappointments which are setting the markets up for reappraisal of the metals. So gold's performing like gold again.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting. You talked about how it gets clobbered every time it tries to form some traction. We saw some of those clobbering events just in the last few days where someone, somewhere, decided they wanted to see gold go down. So, you know, last Friday, $1.2 billion worth of contracts sold onto the market, knocks gold down $8 or $10. And then gold reverses and ends the day strong.
And comes roaring back.
The same thing happened on Monday. My son, Sunday night, while the Super Bowl was going on, he said, "Dad, have the Asian markets opened yet? I wonder if somebody's going to try to clobber gold." Because it had ended strong on Friday. Usually when it does, they try to clobber gold behind the scenes, low volume in Asia. Sure enough, they did. And then, of course, Monday, beautiful.
Came roaring back. And so we have had a dynamic shift. We have had a sentiment change. And you're right, it's the usual suspects trying in Friday's trade, again on Monday before the market opened here in New York, to obliterate its price. You had massive selling operations, and they were met with sufficient buying. By the end of the day, you had a rise in price. So here we are, we've passed the critical demarcations of 1120, of 1140, of 1160, and 1180. Those have been bested technically. And quite frankly, getting above 1180, you've technically negated the downtrend line in place since 2012. And I would like to see 1200 in the rear view. And we may have that this week, but I would like to see it in the rear view before coming to a hard and fast conclusion. But as I said in December, it's either 2016 or it's 2017 that are spectacular years for the metals. Now, it's very sad for those that have been unable to stand the volatility and got out near the lows. But honestly, it's typical. That's very typical of any correction. If you owned it for the wrong reasons, or you doubted the veracity of those reasons, you sold out, and you're probably not going to return to the market. If you owned it for the right reasons, you recognize that in spite of central bank braying about a fixed financial system, little to nothing has changed from 2009 to the present. And quite frankly, the relevance of gold, it never went away.
Well, and Dave, I want to point something out, and this is not to be mean because we're all humans, but I can think of several clients of mine who owned gold through the 1990s. And they just had it. They were done. After Y2K didn't occur or whatever the reasoning.
It's like the shuttering of the mine in 1999. It's like, okay, you know what? We can't make it.
They sold their gold and they bought stocks. They rode them all the way up until 2008. And then the crash came. So they lost money. And then they came back in and bought gold from me. All right. Now, I'm sorry.
Timing's not great.
Well, and a lot of those people have gotten out in this last 3 years. And so sometimes you'll talk to someone and they'll say, "Oh, I don't know what it is. I just always buy and it drops." And it's like, well, think for just a second. Are you possibly buying when everybody else is buying?
Well, that's right. And it's a position which has been unrewarding in the last several years. An unrewarding position is not necessarily a wrong position.
Well, it's like what you talked about with John Templeton.
Yeah, it's not a bad position to have. And last week, yeah, we discussed Templeton's time frame of, say, 5 years and his willingness to allow time to test a thesis.
And even a 5-year period would be worthwhile. Like with gold, we've had a 3-year hiatus, but we may see in this 5-year period that it proves itself out as a valuable investment.
I think time's tested the gold thesis, and now it's game time. You've got central bankers that are desperate to prove their relevance, and they're going to fight for headlines. They're going to fight for market impact. Gold may temporarily fall out of favor, but not once in 5,000 years has it lost its luster. So the last 3 years have been a hard slog. The primary reason, most recently, to doubt a move in gold was rapidly rising rates, the promise of interest rates rising, the dollar moving up in lockstep. Those reasons are gone.
Well, then I'm going to shift to something that's near and dear to a lot of people's hearts, okay, especially our clients who live in the Dakotas, in Texas. You know, energy has taken it on the chin, and we're seeing a large amount of job losses. We're seeing checks that would normally come in from well royalties not coming in anymore. And so what do you think on the energy sector? Are we seeing signs of a bottoming, or do we have more to endure?
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, Exxon is on the verge of losing a credit rating that it's held since 1930. So, you know, note to self, significant changes. That's a headline worth remembering. It's the first downgrade for that company in 86 years. And if it occurs, I think it will signal a bottoming process, not necessarily a bottom. You've got Chevron, you've got Royal Dutch, you've got other majors which are well into the credit downgrade cycle. And they've been hit by downgrades. Many of them are still on negative watch. Most of your smaller producers, they've also been downgraded. And this is all typical in a commodity price cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're probably looking at finishing that whole process about 3 years out.
So that hurts for the person who says, you're kidding me. It could take 3 more years for this bottoming process. But in the scheme of things, 3 years is not that long, is it?
That's right. Well, I mean, what I see is investor behavior, which is eager to buy the bottom. And you've got a ton of people who want to call the bottom, buy the bottom, and that's never the mark of the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
When people are eager to buy, that suggests that there is a stronger belief in higher prices than there is in lower prices, and that doesn't mark the bottom of a market. When you get to a cyclical low, when you're in a bear market, sentiment washes out along with price, and people are no longer interested. Does that make sense at all?
You know, it does. And if you're actually running the company, there's been a hesitance to cut production. There's a number of reasons, but they don't seem to want to cut the production even with the price lower.
Well, it's been argued that one reason for the unwillingness of producers to cut their current production is the fear that politicians, both here in the United States and globally, are in the process of forcing a transition away from fossil fuels to renewables, which over a 20-year period will dramatically reduce demand and therefore the price of the commodity.
Well, look at what Obama said last week. You know, he wants to start taxing, what was it, $10 a barrel?
That's right. Add a tax of $10 per barrel of oil to help fund green projects. And I think what you find is that producers want to pump all out. They want to get as much out of the ground at a reasonable price and gather every last dollar. I hate to imagine what kind of regional instability we'll see when or if the oil price dips below 20. It's not as if that's sort of unfamiliar territory in terms of the price, but keep in mind, last time we were there, nearly 15 years ago, 10 to 15 years ago, under $20 a barrel, governments have bumped fiscal spending during that time frame as the price of the commodity was rising, and they can't turn off that spigot, that is the fiscal spending spigot, as fast as the commodity price can drop. So you've got a lot of your Gulf states, which are very politically vulnerable, with too many promises to pay and not enough money to keep them.
You know, another area that we're seeing just void of any kind of return is in the fixed income area. I talked to you yesterday. I have a client who's been a client for 29 years. He's a very valued client of mine. He buys gold on a regular basis. He runs in the Midwest a bank with several branches. And he called me and he said, Kevin, I can't squeeze return. I've got more deposits than I can make loans. The deposit to loan ratio right now is very, very high. People are saving money, like we've talked about. He says, I could be putting those deposits to work somewhere, but I really don't know where to go to squeeze out return. And, you know, your response was ultimately, it's probably going to have to be in government bonds, but he's feeling the heat as a banker of this negative rate environment.
And you're seeing more and more banks having to allocate more and more resources to securities. And that security segment would be fixed income securities. Maybe it's mortgage backed. Maybe it's, as you said, treasuries, 2, 3, 5, 7, 10-year treasuries. And just to follow up on last week's discussion of negative rates, you have embedded in the annual stress tests for 2016 for the U.S. banking industry The banking industry giants have been asked the question, how resilient will your operations be if we implement negative interest rates in this environment? And the test, according to Bloomberg, is going to assess the stability of these institutions with rates going to negative 50 basis points. So that's negative 0.5%.
Right.
And being held there through the first quarter of 2019. So, I mean, already you said it, there's too many deposits in the banking system and nowhere to loan all the money. But imagine that world where treasury yields are negative and banks have had to choose whether or not to pass on those negative rates to depositors. You begin to wonder what relevance is a bank if it's not a safe place to keep deposits. And I can see sometime in the future, the negative rate environment creating a further consolidation in the banking industry, and ultimately this representing a soft nationalization of the entire financial industry, specifically your big banks, who are struggling to survive an ever-flattening yield curve. And this is, again, too many depositors or depositors who just say, we're not interested.
Well, and you know, we've talked about last week that the psychology is different than actually what the equation represents that these bankers have been trying to employ with negative rates. Every time the rates go lower, whether it's zero or negative, people save more money. And, you know, I know Fisher has been talking about just recently saying he's sort of attracted by the whole negative interest rate concept. I don't know why it hasn't worked.
Well, and now this is not Richard Fisher, who we quoted earlier. This is Stanley Fisher, who's also at the Fed. He's the number two guy.
Gosh, I keep getting all these fishermen, you know, these guys mixed up.
Well, he came over from the Bank of Israel.
Okay.
And he did a good job of sort of managing crisis events there. But in a presentation at the Council on Foreign Relations this week, he said, look, I'm changing my mind. I kind of like the idea of negative rates, and I'm impressed by the results that I'm seeing in the countries that have implemented a negative rate policy.
What is he talking about? Where is he impressed with the outcome of negative interest rates?
I have no idea. Sometimes I scratch my head and I think, what is he looking at that I'm not looking at? You've got the consequences of these kinds of policies, which have been and are negative in the commercial banking arena. We've got money markets, which also are experiencing let's call it a Darwinian moment, where they're going to fail a survival test of a financial ice age. In a zero interest rate environment, how do you keep the pulse? They're unable to earn anything, thereby unable to pay anything. And investors are asking, why should I stay?
Sure.
Now, you have Nomura, which is a big bank in Japan, which already is having problems with their money markets because of the Bank of Japan's new negative interest rate policy. And they've basically said, look, we cannot take any more deposits into these structures because there's not enough income for our fees to be paid and for us to pay you anything. Mm-hmm. So again, there is a massive $2 trillion pocket of liquidity in this money market arena, which is going to be looking for a home. And if investors turn away from your commercial venues like banks and bank deposits, and they turn away from money market funds, what do they turn towards?
Right. Well, they're going to fund the government. I mean, the government's not paying much, but they're paying more.
I'm reminded of something I said last week. It's the likelihood that investors are being moved like cattle into the chutes, the ones we described, the Temple Grandin shoots, where government bond markets, you end up shuttling savings into government bond markets, not like you did in World War I and World War II by throwing down the patriotic card and saying, look, if you want to fight the enemy, here's how you help. If you don't want to fight the enemy, then don't buy government bonds.
You just crush the commercial competition.
You crush the commercial competition, you know, and you literally, you've got money market funds and bank CDs go the way of the dodo bird because they can't pay anything. And all that money gets funneled into funding treasury liabilities.
Well, and you know, if we're in a deflation or zero inflation, that's all fine and dandy, especially if you don't have any defaults on those treasury bonds. But the reality is, Dave, that things still cost more and more every year. I mentioned last week how it's nice to have low gas prices, but that's really the only thing that I see that I'm paying less for.
And as long as you can sort of hide the dangers of inflation, investors will see government bonds as a reasonable option, where it still looks like your treasury yields are better than the other options. I guess we can go back to that little diatribe earlier on how investors may not see the forest for the trees, because if you go back just 30, 40 years, what you find is that treasuries, U.S. treasuries, were once known as certificates of confiscation.
Right.
And I think maybe that's a problem for the 2020s. We may not have to deal with that. It may not materialize in the next 2 years. But as people start going into treasuries for whatever reasons, even those that seem self-interested and healthy, they're going to find the old nature of treasuries, again, certificates of confiscation, a real issue.
So instead of actually liking negative rates, Stanley Fisher may want to actually pay closer attention to what's going on in the European banks based on the negative rates.
I don't understand anything that he said about seeing an impressive response from negative interest rate environment. You've got such nastiness brewing in the European banking system. Negative rates are not preventing a serious decline in European bank shares. There are stresses and strains showing up in the credit default swap market in the European banking space. And why? Number one, you've got a slowing economy in Europe in general. Plus, you've got a low to negative interest rate environment, which is not improving profitability or the financial market stability with these banks. And so you've got lost revenues. You've got written into the laws now for bail-ins. Depositors can become shareholders on a forced basis as codified into law. And it makes me think, again, I don't know what he's looking at, but I see that it's cloudy with a 90% chance of rain.
Well, you know, George Washington wrote that you've got to watch out for a government because the government will grow and grow and grow, and it'll act like any animal, okay, when it's threatened with its survival. It'll do anything, including kill the people in the very country that it lives in. And, you know, what we're seeing right now in Europe is they've gone negative. We're talking about this here, possibly in America, to get people to buy government bonds. China is a great example of a slowing economy, a government that's willing to eat its people. They're spending $100 billion a month right now to keep this thing from really showing what's going on underneath the skin.
Right. We've gone over the cash burn rate, that is the monthly decline of China's foreign currency reserves. And we've said that $100 billion a month rate, that's not healthy, that's not sustainable. And this week we have January's numbers, which are true to form. They're consistent. The Chinese foreign currency reserves are down another $99.5 billion.
Well, they didn't break the 100 this time, $99.5 billion.
Right. So this is interesting because you have the IMF who's now expressing deep concerns about China's financial stability. Should that number slip from the current 3.2, again, we're adjusting from last month, 3.3, now 3.2. The IMF says if it slips below 2.7, we've got a significant crisis. Mm. And again, $800 billion is the total decline since July of 2015. They're spending these resources to defend their currency, and it's at a very high cost.
This is reminding me so much, Dave, of 1992. Now, we've talked about 1992 before, but if you remember, we had the exchange rate mechanism in Europe, and currencies were not able to maintain within the band that they had all agreed to maintain in. So George Soros, if I remember right, saw the unsustainability of the exchange rate mechanism, and he bet big against the British pound.
Right. Kyle Bass is, I think, trying to mimic the trade to some degree, and other hedge funds are lining up, like that 1992 event where they were lining up against the pound. Now they're lining up against the yuan on the belief that you will see a massive devaluation, 30, 40%. Because these interventions are not sustainable, and ultimately they'll have to devalue. So the exchange rate mechanism was a currency arrangement in Europe, which Soros believed was unsustainable. He bet against it. That's what they're doing in China. And I smile because there may be a significant difference in the current trade, because you're dealing with folks that can go nuclear on you.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Quite literally. But you know, you've got the Chinese Politburo and you've got the PBOC with the benefit of hindsight and the lessons learned in that 1992 period. Did they want to lose face to U.S. hedge funds? I think they may attempt to, who knows if they can succeed or if they will succeed, but they may just want to wreck the trade to prove that they carry a big stick. So the longer it takes for that trade to work out, the longer it takes for the yuan to be devalued, the less profitable it is, and ultimately the higher the likelihood that all those hedge funds have to basically throw up and reverse their trades.
Well, and it could be that this is one of the reasons why the Chinese have been accumulating so much gold. You know, I had a client come in yesterday just to pick up a statement, and we talked a little bit about the goings on in the gold market. And he said, Kevin, have you been calculating the Dow gold ratio? Now, this is an important point. The Dow gold ratio, you just, of course, take the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which right now is, you know, about 15, 16,000. And you divide that by the price of gold, which is in the high 1100s right now. The ratio we saw at one point all the way up in the 40s, you know, you could get over 40 ounces of gold for a share of the Dow back in the year 2000. And then, of course, we saw it get all the way to six and then swing back up into the mid-teens. But we're starting to see some real action. The Dow's going down. Gold's going up. Haven't you been calling for a 3-to-1, 2-to-1, possibly even a 1-to-1 ratio at some point?
Yeah, on an economic basis, I think the 3-to-1 ratio is a given. Where you get to a 2 or 1-to-1 ratio between the Dow and gold is when an economic environment is exaggerated by political or geopolitical pressures. Mm. And so, right, the higher the number, the more attractive gold is. Now, counterintuitively here, because again, the highest that number has ever been was about the time that Silverton mines were closing down.
Yeah.
And you were at 43-to-1 on the Dow gold ratio. It may have on a day slipped up to 45 just on a single day trade, but that was roughly where it was in the mid 40s. Then, it, as you said, it slipped to 6-to-1 ratio by the time we got to 2012, jumped to 17-to-1. Which, again, from 45 to 17, you're still well ahead of the curve going back to, you know, performance starting in the new millennium. Now we're at 13.5.
Mm-hmm.
We're targeting 9 as an initial play. I believe we'll see 9 this year. And then I think by the time we head into 2017, we see 6. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if by the time we are in the year 2018, we're at a 3-to-1 ratio. Keep in mind, gold's recorded 3 straight weeks of higher closes. So we need a little bit of digestion. That would be nice.
Right.
Seeing it consolidate, maybe even consolidate at lower numbers between 1110 and 1130. The next major move higher has to take out 1200. And then it's en route to 1350. And these, I think, are numbers that will correspond with the next leg down in the stock market indexes. So you've got January 20th, the lows that were set for the Dow of 15,450 and the S&P 500 at about 812. Those are going to correspond with a 1350 gold price, I think, sometime in here as we head towards a 9-to-1 ratio and then ultimately slip in the years ahead to a 6 and ultimately a 3-to-1 ratio.
Well, and the beauty of the Dow gold ratio is you're measuring two things that have value, not a paper currency. So it's an easier thing in the long run to actually calculate. Sometimes it's better to have heavier in stocks. Sometimes it's better to have heavier in gold. You know, Bill King, who's a regular guest of ours, has shown, though, if you take 15 years, if you take 50 years, it's always good to have some gold because in the long run, gold still, no matter what the Dow gold ratio is, gold in the long run outperforms like the S&P 500, which is a broader index of stocks.
Right. The argument that's typically made against owning gold for a long period of time, because when people are making this argument, they say it sorely underperforms stocks, is when they incorporate a time frame that captures from 1933 to about 1967, when the official price of gold was set in stone. Of course, it was officially set free and allowed to float in the 70s, right? But that period of about 40 odd years mutes the total returns for gold because it was fixed.
Right.
In a freely trading market, say 1967 to the present, roughly a 50-year span or shorter time frame, the last 15 years from the year 2000 to the present, gold has outperformed stocks not just by a small margin.
Right.
So I think when I look at the Dow gold ratio, it continues to be a very intriguing value reference point where there is a time to exit the gold trade. There is a time to use your ounces as capital, as cash, to buy real assets. And historically, that needs to be at roughly a 3-to-1 to be really compelling. And you may even see a 2-to-1 or a 1-to-1 ratio. You say, well, we've just had a correction in the stock market. Surely the stock market is already of value. And I'd say, look, even if Warren Buffett were standing on stage answering the question, you know, his favorite measure of market cap of the stock market compared to GDP, this is what he considers to be the best valuation metric. It still is 2 standard deviations above the mean. It is well above right now the valuation levels that we had at the peak in 2007 in that housing bubble era. And it's now just a skosh below the 2015 highs.
So we still have plenty to go on the downside, you know, and contrary to what Friday, my wife called me and she said, hey, Kevin, I thought you just ought to know Obama's going to get on TV. He's going to talk about the economy. That usually does affect the market. I was appreciative that my wife was paying close attention, but Obama got on TV really to let us know that we were the strongest, most resilient economy in the world. And he said, hey, how about that jobs number? 4.9%. That's it. That's the only unemployment we really have.
Well, and curiously, for the month of January, I think this would be the first time in the non-farm payroll history that you've added close to 60,000 jobs in January. Normally, those are positions eliminated after the holiday season, but retailers are supposed to have added 58,000 jobs in January, which I find hard to believe. I also find it hard to believe that we, in the middle of an industrial recession, added 29,000 manufacturing jobs.
Dave, I've mentioned in the past that I was a toy store manager before I came here while I was in college, and we would run a crew of about 130 people up to Christmas, and we would reduce that to less than 30 right after Christmas. So strangely, I'm wondering what retail and non-farm payroll jobs are being added to that degree in January.
Well, what's being added is pressure from the White House to take advantage of particular numbers that can be entirely politicized coming into the kabuki theater that we have. We call it the political process, the election process.
Right.
But you know that between that particular number, the employment number, and the GDP growth figures, these two are going to be monkeyed with all year long to prove one particular point, which is the Democrats have delivered the sun, moon, and stars in terms of recovery to the average man in the street.
We've had this conversation in 2008 on this show. We've had this conversation in 2012 on this show. We're having this conversation in 2016. I don't know. What's the significance? Does it have to do with the Summer Olympics? No, I don't think so. I think it has to do with the election cycle.
Well, let's look at our game plan. As we look back at 2015, I'm going to say we sound a little bit like a scratched record, because the record we played in 2015 was simply this. You need to reduce your equity positions. You need to effectively hedge them. We said that before the stock market started selling off 10%. There may be another 20 or 30% in declines ahead of us. We still reiterate, you need to reduce your equity positions and effectively hedge them. Otherwise, you need to raise cash and you need to put away adequate amounts of gold and silver. And as a speculative play, going back to Silverton and the ski trip, as a speculative play on the price of metals, choose a few miners in the proper jurisdiction and see what happens next. It needs to be an amount that you can stomach, because we are talking about volatility. We are talking about an instance where some simply cannot hold on, even if we have turned the corner. They've gone too far in terms of debt obligations.
So, what would you say, 10, 15% of a portfolio max?
Oh, not more than that. Not more than that. And that's enough as a speculative play to be very interesting over the next couple of years. So cash, gold, a few mining shares, hedged equity positions. You know, there are a few places in the fixed income space that you can weasel out, you know, a percent or percent and a half and not take on too much risk. But this is a period of time where you want to be cautious because of the character of the political operators. You want to be cautious because of the character of the central planners. You want to be cautious because of the trends in play which define you as an average investor, who is nothing more than fodder for the system. Understand what you represent and who you are to the system, and you'll have a much better idea of how to play this over the next few years.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. mcalvany.com. You can give us a call anytime at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvany Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvany Weekly Commentary.